die, Father, is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
This is Red Ice Radio. Thank you for tuning your browser to redicecreations.com or redicemembers.com. Maybe you're listening at another location, a rebroadcast in the future. Well, however that may be, and whenever you're listening, it's good to have you with us. We're always delighted that you want to spend some time with us and learn about new things and hopefully come away with some new additions to your ongoing re-education, or maybe we should say self-education. Today's roundtable discussion features Egypt experts Stephen Mailer, archaeologist and prehistorian, Chris Dunn, craftsman and engineer, Patricia, artist, and Yusuf Aiwan, stonemason, Gary Evans from Infinite Connections, and Brian Forrester, Peruvian expert and sculptor, all of which will be guiding a unique two-week tour of Egypt this coming April. And having this many people on at the same time is always challenging audio-wise. We do have a little bit of an echo in the first hour, but it's going to be taken care of by the second. So thank you for your patience. And we are going to begin to discuss ancient Egypt and the highly advanced civilization that was there way before writing and the Old and New Kingdom. This advanced civilization had knowledge of science based on harmony. Today we're going to discuss their form of technology and specifically the Serapeum. And you might hear some things you haven't heard about before, so stay with us. All right, here we are. So it's called Superior Technologies and Consciousness of the Ancients Tour. And I guess we could begin, just asking about whose idea it was to pull all this together to this conference. Was it you, Gary?
I can't get the credit for it. I think it came from Patricia and Stephen, I think.
Oh, you're breaking up there a little bit, but I think we heard Patricia and Stephen as well. What I know anyway is that we've had quite a bit of collaboration between Stephen and Chris Dunn before, Stephen Mailer and Chris Dunn, and you guys' work have been, adding on to a lot of this that has to do with the ancient technologies. And of course, we've had you with us before, Chris, talking about this on the program. So maybe we can shift over a little bit to you, Stephen, and just ask you a little bit about your take on all this and how you see the conference and the tour going.
Well, certainly. Thank you, Henrik. It's great to talk to you. Actually, I've been involved with tours for 20 years, and I first came to Egypt in 1992, and the tour guide I had was Yusuf's father, Hakim, who became my teacher. So I have been involved with different groups doing tours all that time, and to bring it up to where we are now, Patricia came to Egypt with me in 2005, fell in love with the country, said to me then that she wanted to live in Egypt. Came back on another tour that we did in 2007, which was Hakim's last full tour. And then she came to Egypt in 2008, met Yusuf, and now they are married. And Hakim passed, went to the West in 2008. So this has been an idea we've been throwing around for several years. I've done two tours in the past with Christopher. We did a tour in 1999, May of 1999, and we also did a tour in 2004. So we've done tours together, and through the years, we have been colleagues, and have talked about perhaps doing another tour. So really, this present tour came about with discussions I've had with Patricia and Yusuf. They have been doing tour now on their own for the last couple of years. I stopped doing tours with the other groups I was working with, and we decided to do this together. And it actually was about a year ago. I was in Egypt in April of 2012, and we were sitting around, Patricia, I, and Yusuf, and suggested, why don't we try to pull a tour together where we can have Christopher and Brian Foster from Peru, with his knowledge, come together. And this is really, they then were starting to work with Gary. They got involved with Gary, and Gary really has organized this tour, but it's come together through a series of events like that. So I have perhaps the most experience having done tours with Yusuf's father, and he was, of course, the master of tours, the senior tour guide. But now we have this unique ability on this tour to put together all the different insights that we've all had, all these different years, different ideas, different areas of expertise. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to make this tour so unique, is that we're bringing all of us together to share all this. It's going to be an extraordinary event. I think this is a tour that has never been put together like this before.
Indeed, it's going to be really, really exciting. Of course, it's in April. We're going to give out all the details and dates and everything else. But let's shift over to you guys, Patricia and Yusuf. You guys are behind the Kemet School of Ancient Mysticism, and just as Stephen Mailer, of course, I've heard about Hakim before. Unfortunately, we never get an opportunity to have him on the program, but I've always been curious as well, considering what's going on in Egypt today, and maybe we can ask you guys that since you're there, I spent so much time there. Is there any, the kind of work that you guys are doing now with ancient knowledge and everything else, has this opportunity for this kind of work diminished in any way, considering what's going on politically in Egypt? We don't have to spend too much time on this, but I'm always curious to ask about that.
Hi, this is Patricia, and thanks, Heinrich. Yes, we've had a huge dip in tourism here since the revolution 2 years ago. It's severe, and it's really been a bad thing for Egyptians and for Egypt. What we are finding, and as Stephen said, we've been running tours. We worked on or facilitated more than 6 to 7 journeys last year. None of them were affected negatively by any political events, and we don't see it in our daily lives. Everything is business as usual. However, the media seems to have this outblown. They're making things seem so much more worse than, you know, or almost not even, it doesn't even exist what they're saying as far as danger here for visitors. But yes, we do see a decline. However, what we say is it's really great for the people that do make the effort to come, because they're treated like royalty, and we have had doors open to us that have been previously closed to the public for decades.
Yeah.
So it's really been an adventure for us.
Well, see, that's what I've heard as well, that it's actually good, if you will, then, quote-unquote, for those people who are doing a little bit more focus on the ancient knowledge. You want to really get into places where they haven't been before, so that's exciting. Have you guys done, is there anything that has opened up in the last, year or two here now then, that you haven't been able to look at before?
Absolutely. Yusuf could tell you about it. We were able to go into the Ben Pyramid.
One of the sites that we were able, me and Patricia and Stephen, we found the connection to enter, and later the same year, which is last year, they opened it officially, which is the Serapeum in Saqqara. Very important places and evidence for advanced technology, and also one of the big question marks of mysteries in the about how the site connects from the underground. The Serapeum was everything it has, shows that the underground work is part from the same complex that contains pyramids and advanced machining and megalithic stones.
Wow.
So it's a very important piece of the puzzle, the Serapeum.
Indeed. Chris, if I remember correctly, you had a chapter on this in Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, and there is some pretty amazing stuff in there. Tell us a little bit about this, Chris.
Well, to continue on with what Yusuf was saying, and hi, Yusuf. Nice to talk to you again. The Serapeum is an amazing place. I was first able to visit that place in 1995, and I was astounded by the level of precision with which these granite boxes were made, and I immediately sensed that there was something really important in these tunnels. There are over 20 of these boxes, and they weigh probably around 70 tons with their lids, or probably around 100 tons. So the question around the Serapeum and what it contains continues to mystify, and there's all kinds of speculation. But there's one thing that we are very certain of, and that is that they had to have had a much higher level of technology to create them than what conventional archaeologists, Egyptologists discuss in their literature with respect to the kind of tools that the ancient Egyptians had. They had to have had much more highly advanced tools. So the speculations about their use, the theory, the conventional theory, is that they were built or constructed to contain the carcasses of the sacred Apis bull, and that seems to wash away when you start to examine in great detail the how they came by this speculation. And I'm sure Stephen can talk more about that at length, but yeah, he's chuckling in the background.
It's usually at this point where Christopher says, when did they introduce the bull?
Right, and they introduced it when they speculated that that's what they were used for, I think.
Right.
I think there are serious questions to be asked. One of the things about Egypt, and I've been there 9 times, it's my spiritual home in many ways, particularly when we go south to Luxor and into the temples along the Nile. It is definitely a life-changing experience. It's a transformational experience. And as an engineer, I go there and I'm humbled by what the ancient Egyptians accomplished. In other words, when we compare what they did with our modern society, it would really stretch our abilities to the limits to recreate it. In some respects, we probably wouldn't attempt it because of the enormous difficulty in constructing some of the monuments that they constructed back then.
Well, it's an amazing find, of course, and if we stay on that for a little bit more here, Chris, you wrote about it first, correct? And then you actually had an opportunity to get in there. Is that how it unfolded for you?
Yes, I've been able to get in there. I tagged along with Graham Hancock and Robert Bavall when they were filming with Netherlands Television back in 1995. And I had a simple straight edge. It was it was a very short straight edge, but it was precise. It had a surface tolerance of about 2/10,000ths of an inch. But that was enough for me to indicate to me that there was something more about these boxes than what we've been led to believe. Following trips to Egypt, I attempted to get into the Serapeum several times. In 1999, I attempted to get back in there. It was impossible. Then in 2001, I got permission from Mazai Hawass to go in there. And I was able to take better instruments to do further measurements. And those photographs, I think they're on my website, gizapower.com, and I think they're also in my book, obviously. And I discuss it in great detail in Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. But that to me is the smoking gun. Mm. It is an incredible sight.
And so all of this is underground as well. Maybe we come back to you a little bit, Yusuf, and ask if there's any tradition or storytelling, I guess we could say, that goes involved in what these boxes were used for, if we want to kind of counter that the sacred Apis bull argument there.
Yes, of course. It could have been used as that, but that doesn't mean this is the original purpose it was used for. And that's exactly how the Egyptologist can date and relate, or put the timelines, or say this was made by whom, is according to the writings. So these boxes had writings on them. But if we compare between the handicraft or the craft the machining of the boxes and the handwork of the writing, it's so obvious to recognize that these writings were added much later. Mm. And it doesn't really identify this device. Who was it built for? Why was it built for? So this is what we know in comitology as the site transformation.
Computer.
This is what happened. You know, people inherited very, very ancient sites and then added writings to them and layers and layers and layers of history. And then Egyptologists will come after that and put them according to the writings on them and take Ramses II, for example.
Yeah.
So many items, many statues, many sites had carvings from the period of time which is related to the New Kingdom, and archaeologists and Egyptologists related to the New Kingdom, while the site is much more ancient and there are evidence, sometimes on the same site, for you can find like Karnak Temple in Luxor. It's 2,000 years of writings inside this great temple. So they're when they look at something like this, they will understand like it took 2,000 years to be built. That's how they understand it, because it has 2,000 years of writings. But we believe that the sites are much, much more ancient than any writings, because we find original sites with no writings added to them.
Hmm.
And we see sites that's related to the old kingdom, supposedly the original elders, and we can see the transformation in it, that they were not originally the ones who built it. We take a good example as the underground, also caves and shafts on the Giza Plateau, which big part of it was transformed into tombs for the old kingdom 5,000 years ago.
Hmm.
So even the old kingdom is just another layer of transformation. It's not the original.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. I want to bring in everyone into the conversation as well. Brian, let's just shift over a little bit, focus on you. You obviously have been over in South America. Look at this over there. First of all, I want to ask you if you've ever been to Egypt before. I guess you have, but there are similar scenarios as well when we looked at the Inca Empire, where we basically have a later civilization taking credit for something that a much, much older civilization actually has done, correct?
Well, exactly. The thing is, I haven't actually been to Egypt. I've always wanted to go, but now is the critical time to go because I get to share an experience with profound people. You know, if I was to have gone before, I would have been wandering by myself. But now I have the brilliance of the other guests to teach me. But definitely what we see here, I'm in Cusco, is that we see definite evidence that a much older culture than the Inca existed here, and that the Inca adopted Cusco. And similar to what is seen in Egypt is that the oldest work is the finest work, and the oldest work is the megalithic work. The later work is the Inca, but most archaeologists who don't want to delve into the idea that there was a culture several thousand years older than the Inca simply label everything as being Inca. But the more you look, the more obvious it is that there was a much more profoundly advanced culture thousands of years before the word Inca even existed.
Yeah, that's right. Very, very interesting. Now, Stephen, let's go back to you a little bit here. I want to hear what you have to say about this, the Serapeum and the findings there. Have you been there yourself yet?
Yes. Yes, I've been actually twice. Actually, what Yusuf said was beautiful, and I want people to understand how wonderful he expressed this. He expresses basically the theme that we're going to be on this tour, and which is now the main theme of the Kemet School of Ancient Mysticism, which we call and Kemetology, which Hakim and I basically invented. What is Kemetology was really the teachings that Hakim was doing on his own, basically, and I'll explain that, because Hakim's uniqueness was that he was an indigenous wisdom keeper. At a young age, maybe the age of 6 to 8, he was chosen by his mother and his mother's brother, his uncle, to be a keeper, to be understanding the wisdom that was from the indigenous people. So all through his young life, Hakim went all over Egypt and met with the elders at every site to learn about what was the wisdom at each site. He was the one that put it together, though. The uniqueness of Hakim is that from the age of 6, with a desire to learn what everything was there, he went on and became an archaeologist, Egyptologist. He held dual degrees from what was then called Fuad University. It is today Cairo University. He was one of the first licensed tour guides in 1952 after the revolution, which overthrew the kingship, which overthrew King Farouk. And the generals took over and Nasser became the ruler. He was one of the first. So up until his passing, his going to the West in 2008, he was 56 years an active tour guide. So he knew more than anybody. And it is the theme of how he taught that Yusuf presented to us, to look at the sites and understand what he called transformation of the sites. What Hakim's teachings would be, as we used to say, would be like peeling away the layers of an onion. He'd peel away the Muslim current Egyptian layer. He'd peel away the Coptic Christian layer. He'd peel away the Jewish layer. He'd peel away the Greek layer, the Roman layer, then the dynastic layer, and underneath would be ancient Kemet. He was the only one that could do that. And that's how Yusuf is teaching, following in his father's footsteps, but is his own man with his own brilliance and understanding what is at the sites. Again, as he said, the key theme to us is you cannot date these structures by what is written on them. We will say that again. You cannot date these structures by what is written on them. As Yusuf brilliantly said, some of the writing could be thousands upon thousands of years later. We're looking at a civilization that was before writing. The most ancient of these structures, there will be no writing, no scripts whatsoever. And there will be no writing, no scripts to say how pyramids were built, because they were built before writing. So to go back to the Serapeum, the evidence that has gone for it to say that it was bulls is, as Yusuf said, they may have been reused. This is one of the things we're discussing about with people. A lot of these stone boxes that we're going to be talking about may have had an original function of producing energy, but they may have been used to bury later on. But there never was a bull. I want to make that clear to people. When we're going to take people into the Serapeum, there has never been a mummy of a bull ever found in there. They found a mummified head. 1846, Auguste Mariette, French Egyptologist, one of the first people to enter in there, found a mummified head in the corridor. In a cache next to the Serapeum, they found a wooden box. A wooden box with bull bones in it. This is only what the only evidence they have to attribute to the fact that these were sarcophagus for bulls. And there were 22 boxes I counted. We believe there are many more. There'll be many, many layers of this. It is my opinion, just my opinion, I'm saying, that this place was, as Christopher Dunn has labeled the Great Pyramid, a power plant. I think the Serapeum was a power station.
Very interesting. We, of course, want to try to get closer to what the origin really is like here and try to understand it. And indeed, very interesting if we're talking about a civilization who hasn't even gotten writing at this point in the way we think about it, but they do have this advanced technology. How much different they must have been in that regard. But everything we see associated with Egypt, with hieroglyphs, the there's a clothing style, there's an art style and everything else. Is this something, Yusuf, that you kind of want to throw out the door, if you will, to be able to get closer to what it actually was like? Or is there any echoes in that type of civilization of the original one, do you think?
Well, the research is like steps of knowing. And we can, in my opinion, to see it right, we don't skip steps to see like beyond it, unless we are aware of the first one. So it becomes a solid step that you go and raise and don't have to go back again. So the first step of research, it's the machining. It's the how they cut these megalithic pieces and how they transfer them. Because being aware of this kind of energy, then we will be aware also what kind of devices be used to also like conduct or produce or generate similar type of power, because we're talking about a kind of power that's, it's not like, not of the types that we are using in our culture and civilization. We're talking about bioenergies. And this is very, very flexible world. It almost contain everything, and that's what almost what we see in the site. We see everything, every stream of energy running through, from natural elements, sound frequency, magnets, electromagnetic, radiobiology, cosmic radio, you name it. And this is from the part that, so we see it as three parts, how it was made, how it was working, how it was functioning, what's the dynamics of it, and then why it was made. This is the three levels of looking at the sites. And more than one pyramid can be part of the same complex. Actually, the whole Buwazir can be one huge complex connecting through the under, connecting in the construction through the underground work of shafts and tunnels that goes for miles underground, and also can be connected through other streams of energy like frequency or magnets. Not to mention that it's all built on the ley line, all of it. So there is a much bigger scale to look at the ancient Egyptian sites and lifetimes of researching. So we're so grateful, of course, for all the work my father did and Stephen and everybody. But I'm talking especially or specifically about Kemetology for my father and Stephen Miller, how they developed the seed of something very special. And when we launched this website, me and Patricia, this tour was the tour I'm hoping for to be like on the right track of the teachings of Kemetology.
Yeah, well, just to come in on the how and the why, I think that is one of the most interesting things about the tour that we put together, because we've got a good deal of people, of the speakers that are going to be dealing with the how, and then there's another section of us that are really dealing with the why the sites were made, why the priority that they had, because it was definitely a different mindset when we're talking about would we be able to recreate these sites today. We'd look at it in monetary terms, but their set of priorities appears to be some kind of spiritual growth underneath everything, and that for me is one of the biggest purposes of my life, and I think many of our lives, how we grow. And it's kind of a general perception is, why are you interested in ancient history? Why is it relevant to me today? How does it help me tomorrow? Well, these sites, ancient sites across the world, Egypt, preservation of them is just incredible. I spent a lot of time in Central America recently, and the ravages of time and the environment has really played havoc there. With just the sand covering sites in Egypt.
You're breaking up a little bit, Gary. I'm sorry. I don't know why that's happening. We can't hear you properly. Stephen, did you catch any of this? Is this something you can continue commenting
yes.
on?
Yes. Well, Gary's talking about the magnificence of the sites in Egypt and the fact that I think he was mentioning being to South America and Central America, you know, the different environmental situations determine what is preserved and what we can study. And Brian is lucky where he is in Peru and Bolivia. There's a lot of dry, arid. He's finding a lot of burials, a lot of evidence. The amazing thing about Egypt is what Gary was leading to is the preservation, is the desert conditions, which have preserved so much of what is there. And, you know, one of the things we always agreed with Zahi Hawass about is when he would state that less than 18% of what's under the sand of Egypt has been uncovered. And again, I point this out, and the magnificence of this tour for people to see is that Yusuf Awiyan is his father's son, but he is his own man, and he uses his own senses. And when he goes out in the field, he discovers something new every time he goes out there. So it's an amazing thing that we continue to find new things, just continue to expand. As he said, we have just made the first steps in the field of Kemetology. It's in its infancy, but we're getting add to it. We have more people coming in. People use their own impressions, their own ideas, and it adds to the field. But it is the idea of the fact that Hakim basically was the first one who was presenting the idea that there was an advanced civilization throughout this area of northern Africa over 10,000 years ago. And what we call Kemet is actually, as he said, would be people of Africa, Europe, and Asia. So it was 42 tribes of people, basically the 42 tribe, main tribes of people on the earth today, and it extended not just in Africa. And that's something that people need to understand that what we would consider the Middle East, Central Asia, even going into parts of deep Asia, mm-hmm. and parts of Europe were part of Kemet, all had pyramids, all had temples, and may all have been in communication with each other.
Do you want to talk more about the stone boxes and their use of, and just try to describe the magnificent, basically the architectural feat of pulling this off? Because they're also in a location, as far as I understand it, of being like, wait a minute, how did they even get these things in here? Or did they build them in there? What do you think, Chris?
Right. The boxes are down deep underground. They're in the limestone rock tunnels. The stone came from Aswan, so they were brought down from the Nile, or they came 500 miles to this place. They were brought underground in a rough state, and then they were finished underground. The evidence of that can be seen in the site where you go down into the tunnels. There is a hall at the bottom of the ramp, and you'll see a rough box in a passageway. And then there is a rough lid, unfinished. But then when you start going through the tunnels and you're looking to the right, you're looking to the left, you've got these crypts. And inside the crypts are the boxes, finished, beautifully finished on the inside. Some are rough on the outside, but all of them are beautifully finished with their lids perfectly flat and perfectly square with the surfaces. So they're definitely very advanced technology was used to create them. When I first came across these in 1995, I went to several manufacturers in the States to see if I could get one of them to quote the manufacturer of one or to make one. The only company that responded was TrueStone in Minnesota, and they essentially told me that they couldn't make it out of one solid piece. They would have to fabricate it or make it out of five separate pieces and bolt it together. So the that doesn't mean to say that if NASA got the funding to create something like this, they wouldn't be able to do it. Of mm-hmm. course they would, but if we don't have the tools right now, the machines right now to create them don't exist. We'd have to design and build them specially to do it. Mm. Now, on the subject that Yousef touched on, which, there are several things about them. I absolutely agree with the adoption theory, where the later scratches that appear on these artifacts are not the work of the original craftsman, and that is obvious from a craftsman's point of view, engineer's point of view, even a layman's point of view. I mean, you just look at it and you say, yeah, there's a huge difference there. But the purpose of them, I agree also that it has to have some kind of scientific basis, because the importance of these boxes is the precision, and you don't create that kind of precision unless you have an absolute need for it, because the costs are enormous to create that. I don't think a lot of people don't understand just what it would take to make just one square foot of a granite surface perfectly flat within 2/10,000ths of an inch. But when you look at the inside of these boxes and you're talking about 6 feet by 12 feet by 7 feet, it's a tremendous feat of craftsmanship. It's not just the tools that they would have used to cut them, but the tools that they would have needed to inspect them, to check them, to make sure that they were precise. But getting to the purpose, the scientific purpose, there are some clues, and the clues are in the Serapeum with the boxes are that the boxes are in recesses in the floor. Why would they see fit to put them in recesses? Well, I think what we have to look at is the entire site, which is Saqqara, where the step pyramid is. And my sense there is that that entire area is like a sounding board. It responds to vibration. And, that... that is a phenomenon that everybody notes when they go through that, and that is the energy of the site. It seems that, there are areas there they call the healing temple, where you can get these really, really deep, resonant vibrations just leaning into a recess in a wall. And it's quite an incredible experience. But if the whole area was based on energy and vibration, then the objects that would be vibrating would need to be secured so they wouldn't walk across the floor, because that's what happens. If you have a surface that is vibrating and you've got an object sitting on top of it and it's not restrained, then it will tend to walk. And that's why I think those boxes are in those recesses. Now, the ultimate purpose, that's, you know, we're open to speculation on that.
Sure, definitely. Now, yeah, go ahead, Chris, continue.
No, I'm just saying is that there is an acoustic science, and their technology, their science was based on vibration, acoustics, and harmony, and a connectivity with the universe. So, you know, they were not just engineers, they were spiritual engineers. They were bringing in information and manifesting a society that was based on harmony.
Is this about amplifying something that's natural? I think Yusuf mentioned organic energy or biological kind of electricity, if you will, before.
Yes, I think if you look at the human body is affected by the technology that is created. And so if you live in a city and the technology is not based on harmony, it is raucous or it is crude, then the body breaks down. But if you live in a village or an environment that is based on harmony, you know, it's musical. Music affects the mind, it affects the body, it affects the spirit. So I think that is what we're finding in Egypt, is that this ancient culture, the Kemetians, had developed their technology and science based on the harmony of the universe and the harmony and frequencies of the planet and the body.
What Chris said is perfectly right. What we're talking about is a people, the ancient Kemetians, who had no separation between science, engineering, technology, and spirituality. When people talk about, a lot of times when they discuss Chris Dunn's work on the Giza power plant, they only concentrate on the nuts and bolts, the technology. But when we talk about the Great Pyramid, we say it was a spiritual machine, and both things have to be understood. These were people who did not have a separation in these concepts like we do in the modern world. And I'm not talking about religion, because this was before religion, and that's a whole other discussion that maybe we could sometimes have by ourselves. It's my second book on the subject. But they did not separate spirituality, technology, engineering. So this is why Chris understood this. As soon as he went to Egypt with his technological mind, seeing it through his eyes, he recognized the advanced technology immediately behind it, but he also, his own spirituality opened. It opened up his own side of himself when he realized these were people who were in a very high spiritual state too, and that's exactly what Hakim taught us. There was no separation. This is all a highly spiritual people who are highly technological and advanced.
Indeed. Was this something that, well, I want to go back to you again, Yusuf, or Patricia as well, because we talked about Hakim a little bit earlier. Do we know who his teacher was? Can we track back where the beginning of the origins of this is coming from?
Yeah, I will somehow complain. This was what Gary was trying to explain here, that the sites are still producing energy and biopower that sometimes also help develop something in our intelligence or our awareness of recognizing this kind of technology or this kind of civilization. So through my experience, and as also Chris said, this is a life-changing experience, like being into the ancient sites. And it is a life-changing experience for me. So I guess with what my father gathered through the elders at the sites and through what he learned as an Egyptologist and archaeologist, but more through what he developed just being touring in the sites and opening channels of awareness. So through that you can develop something unique. That's my opinion about it.
Yeah.
The sites are still giving us something, even though we're not putting a label for it. We can call it the radiobiology, but it can be just one thing. It interacts with us, or we interact with it. So somehow I see it as originally with our full senses, we would be more powerful than the sites. Mm-hmm. But but the world we are living in today, like not tuned in with nature, like the ancient lived, that makes the sites are more powerful than us, and they activate us. But if we are tuned in like the ancient used to be, we can be actually more powerful than what the pyramid can channel or can connect to.
So there is nothing, just to clarify this, Yusuf, and anyone can pick up on this if you want to comment, there's nothing missing in the equation here. Nothing has been taken out from the site, which now consequently has diminished or lessened the energy output of the site.
Well, yes, there was lots of things, of course, taken from the sites, because most of the sites, unfortunately, were transformed or used sometimes as quarry. People would go there and take stones or other materials, especially if it was made from precious things like electrum, which is a blend between silver and gold, or gold or silver, even until granite and limestone, they started to take it from the sites. But let's not forget that the ancient chosen the site because it naturally has energy, and then developed it. They developed the mound into a pyramid and upgraded it. Like some of the sites, maybe not much people go to, which is called Sarabit al-Khadim, and it's a huge tower. High on this mountain, there are levels, and they were supported with an alchemy material. What we found, this material is known as niobium, and with later research, we found that it's sheets of powder made from, like man-made, it's not natural, and it helps to amplify the electromagnetic field. So we're talking about people that used the natures, and this is exactly what my father said about the Neters, which translated as the gods of ancient Egypt. They're actually the forces of nature, and this is a reflection of what the ancient Egyptian, and I'm talking about the old kingdom, understood, because these were the people who inherited the sites in the best conditions, without quarrying or damaging, or people trying to break through to find the treasure, because some of the pyramids were transformed into tombs, and this is why everybody thinks they were. But some of them weren't, and this is the important part.
The key statements Hakim would make was, the site dictates what's there. Exactly what Yusuf said. It's the energy of the site, the underground running water, combining with a natural source of crystal, with what we call igneous stone, which is volcanic rock, which is high crystalline. So you get a combination of running water, acting with crystal field, creates a powerful electromagnetic field. This is the energy of the sites that we feel. And the sites dictate what's there. It's no accident. The Sphinx, the Great Pyramid, and Giza is what it is. Because Giza may be the number one power place in the world. Mm-hmm. So the site dictates what's there. And exactly as he said with the transformation of the sites. Now, you asked a question before about Hakim's lineage. In the last few years, Hakim went into detail with me about his teachers. He particularly mentioned one man named Ismail. He was given a title in Arabic, Zennar. Zennar means the fire of Zen. And then the question is, what does Zen mean? Zen is a Sanskrit word. But Hakim felt it came from an ancient Kemetian term, Zim, which meant consciousness. So it also means in Sanskrit, meditation. So Zennar would have meant the fire of meditation. This man taught Hakim at the age of 6. He was a Sufi master. So Hakim's tradition isn't a Sufi tradition. He taught him to memorize the Quran. Every word, every chapter, every phrase at 6 years of age. This is why I witnessed many, many times in the Awiani household, there would be an argument over a phrase in Quran. Hakim had many friends that would be over, and they would be arguing with him. Hakim would say, it's so-and-so and so-and-so. And they would argue, no, no, it's so-and-so and so-and-so. So he would always yell to his daughter, Mariam, to go bring the Quran. They would bring a Quran. And every time I witnessed this, Hakim had it exactly right, word, chapter, phrase, punctuation, everything. So he started out his life memorizing Quran and going from there.
Mm.
And he was then, he was taught in a Sufi tradition. Just like to add, the one expression that we gave him based on his teacher being Zennar, Zahir Was used to use a phrase for Hakim, calling him the father of meditation. He was using it derogatively, but Hakim accepted that, and that was a good compliment, the father of meditation. So I used the phrase for Hakim, Abu Zen, the father of meditation.
I want to go through now one of each and every one of you and give you a couple of minutes. You can mention your websites, about your work, your books, your material, whatever it is. And then, of course, Gary, I want to give you a little bit of time to talk about the event and where people can go and everything.
Okay, well, I'm Stephen Mailer, and I have actually been what could be called an alternative Egyptologist for over 45 years, since 1968. I have a background in archaeology. I was trained in archaeology by one of the great prehistorians of the 20th century, Dr. Francois Bord at the University of Bordeaux. So I have a training in archaeology and geology. I've always had an interest in Egypt since I was a young boy. Basically, I don't have my own website, but I'm connected with the Kemetology.com website, the Kemet School of Ancient Mysticism. I've been involved in tours, as I said, since 1992. I was a student of Hakim's from 1992 to 2008. He and I developed the field of Kemetology together, and I wrote two books with his collaboration. My first book, Land of Osiris, came out in 2001, and From Light into Darkness, which came out in 2005. I still have possibly another book in me. Hakim and I had worked on a lot of things the last few years, including a retranslation of the glyphs, but I don't know if that's going to happen. All I know is I'm very happy to be able to do this teaching with tours. It is a life. It has been a goal of mine for the last 15 years to be able to do a tour with Yusuf Awiyan, and I'm very anxious in April 15th to 28th to do this tour with us in Egypt, and to do a tour with Chris Dunn in the field and Brian Forster and Gary Evans will be a great experience.
I bet it is. So, it's going to be a lot of fun, of course. Anything else, by the way, Stephen? You want to get in there?
Well, it's just that I've had a background in prehistory and archaeology. Since this time, I have two master's degrees. One master's was in human ecology, which I did work in ancient civilizations and how they related to their environment. And then my second master's degree through the Women's Studies Department at San Jose State University was in Egyptology, which I did the role and position of women in ancient Egypt. And so I knew before I ever met Hakim that ancient Egypt was a matriarchy. And when I first met Hakim and he started to talk that way about it being a matriarchy, he actually lived his whole family, his whole life was matriarchal as an ancient Kemetian himself. So that really is what attracted me to him immediately. And as I said, I have been blessed. Not only did he make me his student, but he treated me as his eldest son. The concept of pay it forward is very important. These teachings are not supposed to stay. They have to be going forward. This is what Hakim represents is an unbroken line of oral tradition that has existed for thousands of years. Through me now, through his family, through those that we teach, Yusuf continues the tradition. His nephews, his nieces will continue the tradition. It goes on. It is an unbroken oral tradition of indigenous wisdom.
Very good. Chris, let's shift over to you a little bit. Please tell us about your website and if there's anything you want to give out there for our listeners where we can read more about your work.
Well, certainly. My website is www.gizapower.com. And my background has been in manufacturing for 52 years, and I started to research and write about the Great Pyramid in 1977. And my first book, The Giza Power Plant, was published in 1998. And my second book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, was published in 2010. So my focus has been on the technology, and had always been on the technology. And of course, after a few visits to Egypt, I started to sense that there was a lot more to it than just technology, and started to tune into the spirit of ancient Egypt. And that's what I try to bring to my guests on the tour, is not just to enjoy and appreciate what the ancient Kemetians accomplished in the material world, but how that affected the spiritual world too.
Very good. Thank you, Chris. Brian, let's shift over to you. As you said before, then you're going to go to Egypt now for the first time. It's going to be a lot of fun, I guess, to go with some of the these great people and researchers who are going to dig out a lot of fun information. So I bet you're looking forward to it as well then.
Well, very much so. And I've been a student of Native tradition since I was a young child growing up in Canada. I actually became I gave up my career as a marine biologist in order to become a professional totem pole carver, because I was so much in love with the culture. After that, I moved to Hawaii and got very much involved with the Hawaiian tradition, helped to build a 62-foot sailing voyaging double hull canoe. And then my interest moved to South America. And for the last 6.5 years, I've been studying the Inca and other cultures, because on my very first trip here, I noticed that some of the stone monuments were far more precisely built than others. And because the local tour guides were not very good at being able to distinguish them, I've had to look through as many sources as possible. And that's where we've, thanks to, you know, traveling with Chris as well, we've been able to distinguish at least three different cultures living here. And so I was very lucky to watch a series called The Pyramid Code. And on that, there was a very wise old man who I was glued to when I would see him, and that was Hakim. Mm. And it was after Hakim, seeing Hakim on TV, that I met Stephen. Stephen and I have developed a very close relationship, almost like brothers. And so it's through their eyes and through their experience and being with the Anwan family that draws me to Egypt.
Very good. We're going to talk with you last, Gary, because you have all the details, of course, and websites and everything else like that we want to give out and do that. But let's turn back on the microphone for Patricia and Yusuf so we can hear what you guys are saying. And please tell us a little bit about the Kemetology website and if there's anything else you want to mention about both of your work.
Well, Yosef and I are the co-directors of the Kemet School, and our website is www.kemetology.com. That's KHEMITOLOGY.com. And we also run a very active Facebook group page that people may be interested in joining in. The Kemet School itself is really an open and free forum for anyone interested in Kemetology and ancient mysteries. And aside from the Facebook page, we really have an open door policy at the house for people that come to Egypt to come in, and we share our knowledge. And we also, of course, as you know, we facilitate tours or host tours and speak on tours. This was not our intention, but we were asked to work on several tours and discovered we couldn't actually teach or share the way we wanted to. And we discovered we've collaborated with a tour guide, Muhammad Ibrahim, who is very well seasoned and very well educated, and the three of us together facilitate tours where we're able to do what we want to do with less focus on shopping and more on spending time at the sites. And we also host people that come individually on their own to Giza, and we'll take them out and show them the local sites in and around Giza and the Alexandria area, as I said, also freely sharing the knowledge and teachings of Hakim.
Right, very good. Kemetology.com, that's the website, and there's links to Facebook pages right from there as well. Let's talk about all the details, of course, of where people can go to find out more about the upcoming event.
Okay, so, well, first of all, you can connect, like Patricia suggested, on the Facebook. Both her and I have got our groups on there, and there's a lot of cross pollination. My Facebook group is Infinite, as in infinity, Infinite Connections PR. And if you type that in, you should be able to find it. I've also got infinite-connections.co.uk. That's my website, and we're going to have a lot of information about the tour on there, or you can download the full PDF, a lovely PDF that Patricia's put together with beautiful photographs, and that's on her Chematology website. And just to give a bit of background on how I've come into things for the listeners, I've been studying ancient cultures and earth mysteries on and off for 20 years. And in 2010, I had a big awakening, a sort of transition from an office-based life to following my heart and intuition. And it became I became aware very quickly that once I started down this road, life became very interesting. And so I ended up as an agent for a number of the authors that were associated with the tour and other well-known alternative authors. And that transitioned into being involved with tours to Peru with Brian and Egypt. And really, I wanted to get to the bottom of the truth. I kind of had these deep issues about life and the way that we interact with each other, and an interest in helping people find what was in their heart once I realized how amazing it was to have this change of direction that I could only have dreamed of a few years prior. And Egypt really opened my eyes to the potential out there. So it definitely can have a profound effect on us. And so I've been involved with a lot of conferences, and I'm not interested in sort of going off on some tangent of what I think's true. I really want to get to the bottom of what really is and what can help people. So you have to be prepared to change your perspective, which is quite difficult as humans. We get attached to ideas, but that's certainly the way that I approach these sites. And I'm interested in the human element. Why do people feel called to Egypt? Because it does seem to pull people there. What can they get from the journey with us? And being involved in tours is definitely a blessing. All of us feel very, very lucky to be involved with tours, and perhaps taking people on their one and only chance to visit these amazing sites. So we really are in dealing with people's dreams. I dreamt of going to Egypt 17 years. I knew I had to go there. I didn't know why. I think I know a bit more now, because it's turned my life around. So we're very focused on the guest experience. I like to look after the kind of, you could say, the health of our guests if they encounter any problems, particularly with sort of food and water. So we're very conscious of giving good advice, looking after people,
right.
keeping an eye on them when they're out and about, because it's a different environment. So we're very focused on that side. And really, I like to interact with the guests before we arrive. So anyone that wants to send me questions, you can contact me through my website. Patricia and I are dealing with a lot of inquiries. We feel that we've put a unique tour together. It's not something we've seen anybody else doing. And it seems to be very well received. We're feeling very lucky. So certainly drop us a line if you've got questions about travelling to Egypt. I've just returned. I've only just been back a couple of weeks. We ran a very successful tour over Christmas and the New Year, so I've been there on the ground. Beautiful, warm Egyptian people, as always, very welcoming. No problems for the tour, despite what you might see on the news. So that's one thing. We can give advice on plane travel. We pick you up at the airport. You won't be off the plane very long, and our representative will be waiting. So it's a sort of full experience. You get to Egypt, or if you're coming from America, you can meet Stephen and possibly Chris at New York Airport and fly over with them. But we've really tried to give it the whole experience and make sure people are well looked after with us, because that's important.
Oh, indeed, very, very much so. So that's that is great. So it's the main Facebook pages and also chematology.com. Is that the main websites to go, and yours as well, of course, Infinite Connections. Gary, is that where people can go?
Yes, infinite-connections.co.uk and Chematology, and both of those websites you can get in touch via email. Otherwise, you can find me on Facebook via Infinite Connections, and Twitter I'm also on, K connections_PR. And yeah, just let us know if you're interested in coming or any questions, and we'll happily answer them.
All right, very good. Thank you, everyone, of course, for sharing some of your details with us. And it's going to be a great event, and we're going to have the links up on redicecreations.com, of course, so you can click through easily if you want to read more or just find out more, curious, or if you already at this point maybe decided that, yep, this is for you, this is something that I want to do, so you can find it easy. But we're going to continue here with another segment, another hour. We're going to take a short break at this point and continue to talk more about the Serapeum, about Kemet and Kemetology and the origins and the purpose. So thank you, everyone, for staying with us, and thank you to all our guests here. We'll be right back after a short break. Talk to you then. In the second hour, Stephen Mailer continues on Kemetology and why these researchers are redefining the field as Kemetology, not Egyptology. He expands on the philosophies of life driven by cycles and explains the stages of consciousness as the ancients understood. We'll speak more about the spiritual machines built at the high point in this cycle. The group expands on the spiritual aspects of the ancients. Yusuf tells us about the power of sound resonance and how each site holds a specific vibration for a specific function. Later, we continue on the power of interdimensional sights as a way to open us up to Neter, an aspect of God. At the end, the group shares details about their upcoming Egyptian tour. To continue listening, you need a subscription to redeyesmembers.com, our members' website, where we have gathered all of our work and past radio programs for easy access for you to stream or download. You can subscribe to the RSS feeds and get the entire archives going back to 2006. When you subscribe, you can download everything that's on there if you like. We're an independent radio program that is constantly growing and expanding. We spare you from commercial interruptions and blinking banners on the website. We are listener-supported, and we are dedicated to education and highlighting both forbidden and hidden knowledge on as many topics as we can wrap our heads around at any given time. We welcome your guest and topic suggestions as well in order to expand into new areas and new understanding also. Our next program, we have Danny Wilton with us to discuss Orion in the Vatican. We have many more coming up, including Robert Tindall, Russell Targ, Lynn Picknett, Randall Carlson, Josh Reeves, Mark Safer, Bill Donahue, and many more. And you have our full list of upcoming guests in our radio archive, either on redicecreations.com or redicemembers.com. All right, we'll return to all our guests on this Egyptology roundtable right now in the second hour.